It's my new obsession. Yeah, pink, it's not even a question. Pink on the lips of your lover. Cause pink is the love you discover.
Welcome to the Marilyn York Show. Warning, this program is not for the faint of heart. Listen at your own peril. If you have questions about marriage, relationships, or divorce, call 823-1920. And now, here's your host, Marilyn York.
You're back on the Marilyn York Show, and thanks for hanging in there, guys. This is Marilyn York, your host, and today's guest is Dr. William O'Donohue, local licensed psychologist. Welcome to the show, Dr. O'Donohue.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Dr. O'Donohue specializes in sexual dysfunctions and deviance, among other things that are, you know, less racy, but you know I don't want to talk about those. So Dr. O'Donohue is a professor of graduate students at UNR and a published author of over 45 books and 150 peer-reviewed journals on the many subjects of psychology, including sexual deviance, child abuse, and rape, to name a few. He has also received research grants from the National Institute of Mental Health related to forensic interviews with children and from the National Institute of Justice to direct a clinic in Northern Nevada that is very, very special and provides free assessment and therapy to children who've been sexually abused and adults who've been sexually assaulted. Is that correct, doctor?
That's correct.
Your credentials for today's topic?
Yes, it does.
So one of the first things I want to talk about is sexual addiction, because it's all over the press right now and it's a popular subject. And I'm sure that we have a incorrect idea of what it really is and how prevalent it really is with all the news about Tiger Woods, Jesse James, and many other movie stars. Let's find out from you, doctor, what is sexual addiction truly?
Well, it's essentially when a person engages in sexual behavior that gets them in trouble, can get them in trouble with others, like their spouses, employers, they don't, when they evaluate their own sexual behavior, they find it problematic. They find that they don't have enough control over their sexuality. They're doing things that they don't want to do because of their moral codes or promises to others. So essentially, it's sexual behavior that's out of control.
So is there like an objective test versus a subjective test? Because like one of the things you just mentioned is religion or their own moral, you know, standing. I would assume that the test generally or the diagnoses would be more objective than that. But I guess that's one of the ideas of whether you're in control yourself of your, you know, desires and going forward with those, or whether it's controlling you is sort of the idea. Is that
that's the idea? Because sexuality has this essentially values dimension. Some people could think because of their religion that masturbation is wrong.
Oh, and I've met those people.
Exactly. And they could find that they're masturbating a couple times a day and they can't, and they've tried for years to stop this and can't. And they can describe themselves as a sex addict just for that kind of behavior. On the other hand, somebody could have had a couple of affairs and their spouse excuses them for that, but says, you know, the next time we're definitely going to get a divorce, and this could have a negative effect on the kids, and they still can't remain faithful. So sexual, the behaviors that comprise what people call sexual addiction vary tremendously based on people's values and their own goals and their own commitments to other people.
So it's like any addiction, I assume. If you're not in control of it, it's more controlling you beyond what you want to be doing. That's sort of the level that would be required for it to be an addiction instead of you just getting a lot of girls on the side.
That's correct.
So the Hollywood scene makes me laugh, because in the non-Hollywood sector, I think most men in particular think, I want to be a movie star or a sports, you know, star so that I can get lots of girls. And then you get to that top level and people are so-called shocked and appalled at the David Duchovny, Charlie Sheen, you know, Colin Farrells of the world, who are, in fact, you know, carrying out what we all thought they were going to Hollywood in the first place to do.
Correct. Many males view multiple partners as a very desirable
rite of passage.
Yeah. And some, you know, don't develop out of that, right? I mean, you can have, look at Hugh Hefner, right? And you don't know how much is real and how much is an image, but...
Yeah, he's how old? 107? Exactly. I mean, can he really, can Viagra work that well?
Exactly. But yeah, it's not a surprise that for many males, if they have the opportunity to have multiple partners, they'll choose that. It's just that, for example, in Tiger Woods' situation, this conflicts with other values they have, that presumably Tiger Woods wants to be a father and a stable family and wants to maintain some sort of relationship with his wife, and his extracurricular activities with his sexuality interfere with that.
It's interesting to me, though, because I had a show on swingers recently, and I was telling them how they have a better code of silence than even NA and AA, because as many divorces as I've done, and it's probably 500 by now at least, I've never, ever had one client tell me that they were, in fact, a swinger. And so I thought, wow, you know, they always tell me who's an NA with them, and it's supposedly anonymous and confidential. So I'm wondering how many of these Hollywood elite types are, in fact, in open marriages or should negotiate with their partner an open marriage concept because they have full expectations and plans to not be faithful. You know, apparently Jada Pinkett Smith and Will Smith, for example, have an open marriage and are open about that fact. I can't believe it's not more prevalent in the Hollywood industry, given their, I guess, availability for other partners.
Well, there's some research data on that, though, that it's very hard to make open marriages work.
That wouldn't surprise me, having not tried it, because it seems so counterintuitive. But there is apparently a statistic out there that said like 10 to 12% of marriages are not monogamous by agreement or nature. And so whenever I say the statistic of cheating, which I've read in numerous places, is somewhere between 60 and 40% of all marriages have an instance of infidelity.
I've heard that statistic, but not the first.
First one, I kind of take it out. It seems high to me.
It seems high to me, too.
But yes. I don't know if this is both partners think it's an open marriage or just one.
Right.
That's what I always tease them. Well, you're not a swinger if your spouse isn't participating. Then you're just cheating, okay?
Well, and some of that, you know, the research literature shows, for example, that gay male couples often define monogamy differently than other sexual orientations, that it's much more common for them to define themselves in a monogamous relationship, yet one day a week, each of them goes out and engages in sexual contact with other people. But they usually have firm rules about this. For example, you can't have lunch, you can't meet on dates, you can't...
There's no lunch. You can, you know, have oral sex, but we'll not be having any sandwiches, mister.
Well, yeah. You know, and there was a fascinating study. Let me tell you this study, you know, because you laughed at it. At University of Michigan, they did a study, and they got attractive males and attractive females as their confederates.
Bait.
Yeah. And they had them go up to people on campus and ask one of three questions. One question was, would you have coffee with me now? Second was, would you go for a date with me this weekend? And third was, would you have sex with me now? So with females, when an attractive male went up to a female, it would be what you would expect, that would you have a coffee with me now? 20% said yes. Would you have a date? 10%. Said yes. We have sex with me now. Essentially, 0% said yes.
Wow. Now,
the surprising thing was with males. So when they attractive females go up to a male saying, asking the same three questions, about 80% of the males said yes, I'll have sex with you now. 40% said I'd have a date, and only 10% said I'd have coffee with you now.
Oh.
So for males, males are much more likely to have sex immediately with a stranger than to have coffee or go on a date.
I can't say I'm surprised, although a little depressed, and feeling a little bit like I'm out of my game, you know, being married right now. I wish I'd known that before. I would have just cut to the chase when that was what I was looking for, you know. It's good advice for those of you who are single and all these girls that call me and say, what do you suggest? How do I get back in the dating pool? Okay, it's the sex pool, apparently, and you don't get into the dating pool. You go up to a man and you say, would you like to have sex with me? And maybe they'll take you to coffee afterwards. I mean, hey. 823-1920 is the call-in number if you guys want to call in. We have a break coming up, and when we get back from the break, we have a call waiting. If you'll sit tight on the line, Grace, we'll get to you as soon as the break is over. And we're going to keep talking about sexual addiction. I'd like to get into some statutory rape and underage, maybe child molestation, but also the Hollywood and advertising world and how it's affecting things. Thanks for listening to the Marilyn York Show with Dr. William O'Donohue, and we'll be back right after the break.
Not just news, your chance to talk about it. Fox 1270 in the morning, weekdays at 6 on Fox News Radio 1270.
Have you ever seen a square foot? Well, we've got 8,800 of them, and they're all fun. We're Junkie, 8,800 square feet of pure fun. Because it's fun to save money, and it's fun to shop at Junkie. Got a theme party coming up? We can help you pull it all together. We've got the right look for your roaring 20s theme party. Been invited to a disco party? Need to look like Madonna or Cyndi Lauper? No problem. Our 80s gear is totally rad. Junkie has clothes for every kind of theme party. And Junkie can save you money on clothes for work, clothes for play, and clothes that are priced so low they just satisfy your urge to shop. You don't have to spend a lot to have a lot of fun. Some of our square feet are devoted to affordable retro furniture and vintage style home decor. You can decorate your home in a unique way at Junkie's Antique Mall. We also have tons of one-of-a-kind jewelry. So for affordable parties, clothes, accessories, retro furniture, and antiques, Junkie's the fun place to shop. Now we'll get serious and tell you where we're located. We're in the big brick building between Vassar and California on Virginia Street. Junkie is obviously the fun place to shop.
If you've never visited the Wild Horse Saloon, you need to come out and visit. It's Nevada's most unique saloon with great food, great libations, amazing entertainment 24 hours a day. What kind of entertainment, you ask? Well, the Wild Horse Saloon has brought back live burlesque shows with new shows starting every hour, 24 hours a day, with different entertainers every hour. No show is ever the same twice. So come to the Wild Horse. Throw your legs over the saddle. We have actual Western saddle bar stools. And order a cold beer. The Wild Horse Saloon is the place to go and let your hair down. Just have fun. We have fabulous food with everything from pizzas and wings to hamburgers and steaks. We're a huge lunch spot from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. And we serve our full food menu until 10 at night. And hors d'oeuvres the rest of the night. I'm Susan Austin, and I'm personally inviting you to come out and see us at the Wild Horse Saloon. Take I-80 East to exit 28. It's just 15 minutes from downtown Reno. Follow the signs to the Wild Horse Canyon from the exit. See you soon.
I'm attorney Marilyn York, and my firm exclusively focuses on men's rights in divorce, child custody, and family law matters. I hate advertising. If I'm being honest, I hate it more than anything. Why should you believe anything I have to say about myself? I'm in the best position to say great things about myself, but you don't know me, and there's no reason for you to trust me. So I'm going to ask you to do one thing. If you need help in family law matters, please ask two people in a town of this size, and you should be able to hear my name. I've been doing this for over 11 years exclusively, and if you can't ask two people you trust about me and hear good things, then I'm not the right attorney for you. On the other hand, I believe you will hear good things about us, and when you do, then we're the law firm for you. At a minimum, you will need legal advice when going through something like this, and you may need representation. Again, this is Marilyn York. Please call us at 324-7979. That's 324-7979. Or visit us on the web at marilynyork.net, not com, marilynyork.net.
There's no one like Michael Savage, and he's live weekdays at 3 on Fox News Radio 1270.
I started having symptoms of menopause when I was 47 years old. The hot flashes and night sweats were almost unbearable. I gained 50 pounds, was irritable, emotional, just not myself. As a registered nurse, I was concerned about taking pharmaceutical hormone replacement therapies because there is a history of breast cancer in my family, plus all of the unknowns when you take drugs. So I tried Amberin. Within 2 weeks, the hot flashes stopped. Yes, they stopped. I have been working with Amberin for almost a year now. I've dropped so much weight. I'm no longer irritable. I sleep great, and I have a ton of energy. One of the most important aspects of this treatment is that there are no side effects. I highly recommend Amberin. Signed, Carol Richardson, RN, and very satisfied Amberin customer. For your free supply of Amberin, visit StopFlashes.com or call 800-890-7728. A limited number of free trials are available. Call 800-890-7728. That's 800-890-7728. 800-890-7728.
Before I started working as a soil scientist.
Before I became a systems engineer.
Before I got started in aerospace.
I was a kid making discoveries.
I did my first lab experiment.
I found out science is cool.
In 4-H.
In 4-H.
In 4-H.
You never know when a spark will ignite the imagination and open up a world of possibilities for a young person. That's why 4-H has taken on the commitment of fostering 1 million new scientists and engineers for America's future workforce. With the help of companies and universities around the country, 4-H is growing the next generation of great thinkers.
1 million new scientists.
1 million new ideas.
Learn more and see how you can help at 4-H.org.
At the JCPenney Father's Day sale this Friday and Saturday, give more style, get more savings. Give Dad shorts and St. John's Bay polos in every
70.
You're back on the Marilyn York Show, and thanks for hanging in with us. We have Grace on line one, and let's take a call from her and see what she has to say about her sexual addiction. Grace, can you hear me?
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Are you a sex addict, Grace? Do you want to know if you are?
But I am concerned that my boyfriend is.
All right. It's never the girls, you know. That's what I want to get into that with the doctor. But why do you think your boyfriend's a sex addict?
Well, I have a couple of questions. First, why is it that men, just in general, like, after you have a big fight, they want to have makeup sex? It just never makes any sense to me, number one. And then two, is somebody a sex addict if they want to have sex 2-3 times a day, every single day?
Doctor, you take these questions because I have my own opinions, but I'm sure they aren't clinically based.
Well, let's take the 2 or 3 times a day wanting to have sex. The answer would generally be no, unless... There would have to be some other feature of the sex that they are having it at work where there's rules against it, or their partner doesn't want it so much that they said, if you keep pressing me for this, we're going to get a divorce. It would have to be interfering with their social or occupational functioning in some way.
In order to become addicted to it?
Exactly. The idea would be, I know I'm going to experience bad consequences for this. I'm going to lose a job. I'm going to lose, you know, this partner. But I'm still going to do this behavior because I don't have control over it. And then they experience the negative consequence. They lose a job, lose the partner, and, get depressed, feel bad because they didn't have control over it.
Now, how does one not have control over something like that? I mean, it just seems so meaningless. For the most part, I mean,
hence the addiction, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well, it's a pleasurable activity. I mean, it's the same reason why people don't have control over eating chocolate or drinking, you know, alcohol or whatever. They're essentially, they love the pleasure that you get from these activities so much so that they can't control it, and it interferes with other goals.
So the first question, doctor, was makeup sex, the concept. I think we have to talk about the differences in males versus females and what the emotional state is for a man for sex versus a female, because that's part of the where the rub lies. I know most of my female friends say, you know, when we're angry or sensitive or feeling vulnerable or emotionally injured, that is not the time when we want to be sexually vulnerable to our partner. And yet men apparently find it as a way to sort of bond or reconnect with their lover. I don't know.
Well, I think the most promising theory of basic human sexuality is the evolutionary theory that essentially states the way we are now has been determined by the selective advantages in our evolutionary past, previous generations. So the reason why we have eyesight is because when that mutation occurred, those organisms that could essentially perceive light, they could get around objects, they could move better, they could find food, they can get away from predators. So now we're sighted creatures, where some, you know, species are not. Now, when you apply this to sexuality, the argument is that male sexuality and female sexuality evolved in different ways. And they evolved in different ways because of what the term is called parental investment. Females essentially are pregnant for 9 months. They then take care of the child, you know, through breastfeeding for, you know, a couple years. They can also have fewer offspring. You know, a woman, if she tried to maximize the number of offspring, could maybe have, you know, 20 or 30
children at one time.
Exactly right. But that would even be tough. Where a male, essentially, we have low parental investment, mean essentially, after we ejaculate, we can leave and we can get our genes in the gene pool. We don't have to, we don't have a pregnancy, a gestation period. We don't have to be intimately involved in raising the child. So the mating strategy for males then is a much more promiscuous one. The idea that if males in our past wanted to maximize the number of genes in the next generation, they were promiscuous. They were visually aroused by cues of youth and health and fertility. They aroused to younger women because that's when women are maximally fertile. And they were promiscuous, where females are much more concerned about the relationship because what they want to do essentially is find a man with high resources to devote those resources to the few offspring that they can have.
So I guess we're being picky when we're in a fight with a jerk because we don't want to necessarily procreate with a jerk. So our maternal instincts, say, would kick in and say, no, no, bad breeding partner. And a man's like, drop a kid off and move on. Who cares?
Exactly.
That's
a woman
the answer.
Could say,
is that the layperson version?
Yeah, I'm seeing bad signs in this relationship in terms of the relationship quality. The female sees that, uninterested in sex. The male can see a opportunity, want to bond with that woman in terms of, you know, sexual monogamy. Because males want females to be sexually monogamous, but they want to be promiscuous.
Of course. So the answer is run, Grace. Shut those legs and forget the makeup sex. Follow the maternal instinct. He's a dog.
Oh,
that's,
boy.
To summarize, that's my non-clinical standpoint on it.
I like it, Marilyn. Thank you very much. Thank you, doctor.
Thank you.
All right.
So back to the sexual addiction topic, doctor. And those of you who want to call in, again, the call number is 823-1920. How, doctor, does a person decide if they're a sex addict? Because it seems to be that Grace's concerns are probably the norm for the Hollywood perspective. Like, someone has a lot of sexual partners and they like to have sex a bunch of times a day. I read a bunch of stuff on Lindsay Lohan, for example. Oh, she's insatiable. Well, that doesn't make her an addict. So what sort of indicators would you like the public to know as far as them trying to evaluate themselves on whether they should seek treatment or consider it as a possibility?
I think there's two. One is, do I feel in control of this? Can I, if I don't want to do it, can I not do it? And the second is my sexual behavior leading to bad outcomes for me? Am I getting sexually transmitted diseases? Am I losing my jobs because I'm looking at porn at work? Am I breaking up in relationships because I'm unfaithful? So again, the two are, do I feel in control? And have I experienced or am I likely to experience serious negative consequences because of my sexual behavior?
I want to give this a little female spin. Being female myself, obviously, and back in my youth, like 13, 14 years old, I can imagine the answers to both of your questions being, you know, no and no as a young female, but not being a sex addict, but rather being sort of a victim of insecurity. For lack of a better concept. And I have, you know, some family members that have young children that make me think of this as well, where one of them I know has sex regularly with very much older, you know, boys. And she's like 13 years old. And it's mostly motivated out of a complete insecurity and lack of self-control in her ability to say no because she wants to be liked and to please. And so it's interesting because I think there's a power difference in the male versus the female from this sexual addiction standpoint. And one may look like an addict per se as a female, but really she's got some other major problem going on.
Yeah. Although it's a separate question of what can drive that addiction, just like alcohol, people can have a physiological craving. They could like the taste. But what's driving the alcoholism could be their depression, or it could be their low self-esteem, or it could be dealing with traumatic memories in the past. So, but I think you raise a good point. The other issue in terms of defining yourself as a sexual addict, just like other addictions, there can be denial and minimization, and other people may see you as having these sexual problems where you are essentially denying them or minimizing them. So it's also important to kind of listen to the perspective of others if that perspective is, you know, valid and reasonable.
So what is priapism? I read about it. Is that a term you're familiar with?
Priapism, yeah.
There, thank you. Tom Sizemore apparently is one of the actors supposedly who has it.
It's essentially having an erection that's painful and long-term.
And this isn't apparently brought on by Viagra.
No.
Okay.
No.
So this is this a new? Is that part of some person's sexual addiction potentially? If this is a condition they have, does that actually help them?
No, because it's painful. People with priapism don't want to have sexual contact. They just can't get rid of the erection, and it's again very painful, and it can last hours. So they usually need medical interventions.
That'd be psychologically awkward, to say the least. And we'll talk when we get back.
Join Bert Ramos for the Balance Report, the voice of reason, a program of civility, respect, and independent thinking. Bring balance to your world Saturday at noon on Fox News 1270.
There's a piece of Nevada's history just 15 minutes from downtown Reno, the legendary Mustang Ranch Museum, Nevada's first legal bordello. Learn about owner Joe Conforti, where he went sideways with the feds over taxes, and they ended up owning and operating the Mustang Ranch. Take a walk down memory lane with Joe and Sally. See where they lived while they worked. You can see the Rolling Stone magazine cover featuring Joe and his ladies, among other original magazine covers. The Mustang Ranch Museum runs tours from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. for groups large and small, Monday through Saturday. If you have a large group, please book in advance by calling 775-343-1424. Walk-ins are welcome, too. Tours cost $5. Plus, we have a wonderful gift shop with T-shirts, shot glasses, baseball caps, and the largest selection of Native American jewelry. Take I-80 East, exit 28, 15 minutes from downtown. Follow the signs to the Wild Horse Canyon from the exit, and that's where you'll find us. If you've never visited the Wild Horse Saloon, you need to come out and visit. It's Nevada's most unique saloon with great food, great libations, amazing entertainment 24 hours a day. What kind of entertainment, you ask? Well, the Wild Horse Saloon has brought back live burlesque shows, with new shows starting every hour, 24 hours a day, with different entertainers every hour. No show is ever the same twice. So come to the Wild Horse. Throw your legs over the saddle. We have actual Western saddle bar stools, and order a cold beer. The Wild Horse Saloon is the place to go and let your hair down. Just have fun. We have fabulous food with everything from pizzas and wings to hamburgers and steaks. We're a huge lunch spot from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., and we serve our full food menu until 10 at night, and hors d'oeuvres the rest of the night. I'm Susan Austin, and I'm personally inviting you to come out and see us at the Wild Horse Saloon. Take I-80 East to exit 28. It's just 15 minutes from downtown Reno. Follow the signs to the Wild Horse Canyon from the exit. See you soon.
Have you ever seen a square foot? Well, we've got 8,800 of them, and they're all fun. We're Junkie, 8,800 square feet of pure fun. Because it's fun to save money, and it's fun to shop at Junkie. Got a theme party coming up? We can help you pull it all together. We've got the right look for your roaring 20s theme party. Been invited to a disco party? Need to look like Madonna or Cyndi Lauper? No problem. Our 80s gear is totally rad. Junkie has clothes for every kind of theme party. And Junkie can save you money on clothes for work, clothes for play, and clothes that are priced so low they just satisfy your urge to shop. You don't have to spend a lot to have a lot of fun. Some of our square feet are devoted to affordable retro furniture and vintage style home decor. You can decorate your home in a unique way at Junkie's Antique Mall. We also have tons of one-of-a-kind jewelry. So for affordable parties, clothes, accessories, retro furniture, and antiques, Junkie's the fun place to shop. Now we'll get serious and tell you where we're located. We're in the big brick building between Vassar and California on Virginia Street. Junkie is obviously the fun place to shop.
If you've never visited the Wild Horse Saloon, you need to come out and visit. It's Nevada's most unique saloon with great food, great libations, amazing entertainment 24 hours a day. What kind of entertainment, you ask? Well, the Wild Horse Saloon has brought back live burlesque shows, with new shows starting every hour, 24 hours a day, with different entertainers every hour. No show is ever the same twice. So come to the Wild Horse. Throw your legs over the saddle. We have actual Western saddle bar stools, and order a cold beer. The Wild Horse Saloon is the place to go and let your hair down. Just have fun. We have fabulous food with everything from pizzas and wings to hamburgers and steaks. We're a huge lunch spot from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., and we serve our full food menu until 10 at night, and hors d'oeuvres the rest of the night. I'm Susan Austin, and I'm personally inviting you to come out and see us at the Wild Horse Saloon. Take I-80 East to exit 28. It's just 15 minutes from downtown Reno. Follow the signs to the Wild Horse Canyon from the exit. See you soon.
Fox 1270.
There was a time when I was
so brokenhearted. Love wasn't much of a friend of mine. The tables have turned. Yeah, calls me and then where's that party? That kind of love was the killing kind. So listen.
You're back on the Marilyn York Show, and thanks for hanging through the break. We are here with Dr. William O'Donohue, and we were talking about sex addiction. And I want to take a little deviation at the moment and still stick with the subject. Doctor, can sexual deviance be an indication of an underlying addiction? Because I know one of the things you indicated is indicative of an addiction is sometimes a lack of appreciation of consequences. And I know sexual deviance in some instances can be consequential. Is there an overlap there?
And you wrote your name right on my back. Boy, your nails were sharp. Don't stop. Honey, don't stop. Don't stop.
Give you an interest. And again, as the other criterion that I talked about, but they have made attempts to stop this behavior, and they find that they can't. And sometimes, again, by the time they come into psychotherapy, they've often experienced a negative life event, such as a spouse has found out about their deviant interest, they've been fired from work because they've been looking at deviant pornography, some sort of problem like that.
We had mentioned at another time during the show the idea of internet access, and to me it seems like that might make it harder for someone trying to recover from this sort of addiction because there's so much accessibility for not just pornography on the internet, but also sexual acts. I mean, you know, live on the internet or Craigslist, Casual Encounters, there's a bunch of different websites. Does that play a part in your recovery work that you do with your clientele?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, there's an array
Fox News Radio,
of,
AM 1270, KBZZ, Sparks, Reno, the service of Americom Broadcasting.
That, you know, there can be just photos, then there can be videos, and there can be kind of live sex, and then there can be actual ways in which you arrange a in-person sexual encounter. And these can be very tempting to individuals, and some people cannot exhibit appropriate self-control, and they end up getting in trouble. And as you talked about before in your previous questions, there's some very deviant sites. I got called up one time by the New York Times, and apparently there's a Japanese site which shows women in high heels, nude, except for the high heels, killing small animals like puppies and kittens and rodents. And apparently some males, this is their fetish interest, that they find this very attractive. And the concern was the U.S. government couldn't shut it down because it was a Japanese site.
As much as this is not a funny topic when we're killing puppies, the Japanese never cease to amaze me with their predilections for strange things that often don't even appear sexual for them. I have a friend that moved over to Japan for a while and was talking about their maid cafes, where apparently you can go into a cafe and have someone dress up as your favorite Japanese anime character and like hand feed you pancakes for breakfast. And it's not directly sexual, but obviously there's some sexuality to it. And it's just a very odd culture as far as their predilections, shall we say.
Yeah, there's also more acceptance of, we would call it hebephilic sex there. Hebephilic means when somebody is aroused by post-adolescent but still very young females, so 15 or 16 years old. Apparently, there's these telephone contacts there where high school girls get into contact with men in exchange, essentially, sexual acts for some money, and apparently the law enforcement in Japan is not attempting to shut it down as much as it would happen in the United States.
That's That's so odd to me because Japanese women or Asian women in general look very young to me. They don't, you know, get large breasts and they don't get the curvy hips like girls do. And they just keep their beautiful, youthful skin and faces. So a lot of times those girls to me look like they're 25, you know, or look like they're 15 when they're 25. So I can't imagine why they need to go down in age to achieve some look that they already have.
Well, and I think the other factor, though, is how patriarchal the society is, that in societies where women have less power, more women are exploited sexually, including, you know, girls or young women.
Yeah, that's definitely an international phenomenon that seems to be coming to the forefront currently. As I indicated before, I'm reading the book Half of the Sky, which is covering that sort of subject, and it's mind-boggling what's still going on out there and how, you know, advanced America is. As much as we think that it's still not equal, we're so much farther along than we realize if you look at the rest of the world.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've seen that in the kind of war in Iraq and Afghanistan and dealing with those cultures to see how advanced America is in terms of its treatment of women.
Yay.
I know we got a long way to go, but, you know, compared to those cultures.
Yeah. When is sexual addiction relevant to a custody case? Doctor, I know you do custody evaluations, so this is an area you would know about. When should, say, a party bring it up if there's a custody battle going on or an evaluation?
Well, the most important concept in a custody evaluation is the best interest of the children. And essentially, what somebody would have to do is to show how the sexual addiction is not in the best interest of the children. And some ways that this can occur is if the parent spends time on their sexual addiction that, you know, takes away from time they ought to spend with their child. So there's, you know, cases where males will spend, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours a day with internet pornography instead of attending the child. A second is if the children can come across this sexual addiction. So if they're using the internet or they have deviant pornography, kind of around, can children come across this and be harmed? And third, I would argue that it's never in the children's best interest to have a parent with a paraphilia diagnosis, you know, somebody that has a DSM diagnosis of essentially a perversion in their lives. And therefore, it's relevant to custody evaluation. If somebody qualifies for the diagnosis, they would need, you know, treatment so the children can live in a healthier household.
What is that? Can you explain that in layman's terms a little better? Like, what sort of things are, you know, encompassed in that diagnosis?
Well, paraphilia, para means outside, like paranormal means outside the normal. Philia means to like. So essentially, paraphilia is an official word in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association. And so it means that somebody likes something sexually that's outside the norm. And that could be pedophilia, both, you know, liking of children.
That would be a big red flag for most parents.
That would be a huge red flag. Hebephilia, again, is this attraction to post-pubescent but still, you know, too young females, like a 14 or 15.
Like An Education, that movie?
Yeah, exactly. And American Beauty would be another example.
Yeah, exactly.
There's various diagnoses in there, from having fetish, which means having a sexual object choice, like you're getting aroused by boots or...
feet or toenails.
Toenails, or for example, in this, you know, case involving Breonna Dennison, an underwear fetish, you know, that's a very common one.
Okay.
You have this unusual attraction, and then it interferes with your social occupational functioning. You experience distress because of it. Now, the problem is most people are in denial or minimizing about their sexual problems.
Well, it would be their spouse that would typically be more aware of it and make a custody evaluator or the court aware of it if they thought there was a predilection.
Exactly right. The spouse finds, you know, evidence of it, but then you get into all these complex problems. You know, it wasn't mine. Somebody else used my computer. It's actually hers. You know, all these complex counterclaims.
Oh, yeah.
Sure,
oh, I've heard them all. Yeah. We're going to go to a break now and hear a word from our sponsors. And when we get back, we'll wrap it up and talk a little bit more about sex addiction and what the treatments are out there. Thank you so much.
We'll be right back. There's no one like Michael Savage, and he's live weekdays at 3 on Fox News Radio 1270.
The Extreme Outlaw.
Hey, it's Traffic Trey Valentine with another Extreme Outlaw update from the Grand Sierra Resort. Practice, as you can hear, is underway, and we are starting to see a whole lot of huge air off the over-under bridge. Guys slipping and sliding in the turns and berms. Qualifying for Supermoto, of course, starts at 11:30. That throttles up from 11:30 until everyone gets qualified. And then we'll see an FMX demo from LiveFast at 1 p.m., followed by an autograph session as well. That's what's so great about Supermoto here at the Grand Sierra Resort. Everybody is accessible, so if you want to come out here and meet these guys doing the backflips, you have this is definitely the place to see it. And then at 2 o'clock, we go live with Supermoto Racing. Now, we still haven't heard from anyone out in the desert race yet, so we're still waiting for the fast guys to check in. But we are at the pits, and as soon as they check in and we get an update of who's out there, we will let you know. Keep listening for another Extreme Outlaw update. It's coming up.
There's a piece of Nevada's history just 15 minutes from downtown Reno, the legendary Mustang Ranch Museum, Nevada's first legal bordello. Learn about owner Joe Conforti, where he went sideways with the feds over taxes, and they ended up owning and operating the Mustang Ranch. Take a walk down memory lane with Joe and Sally. See where they lived while they worked. You can see the Rolling Stone magazine cover featuring Joe and his ladies, among other original magazine covers. The Mustang Ranch Museum runs tours from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. for groups large and small, Monday through Saturday. If you have a large group, please book in advance by calling 775-343-1424. Walk-ins are welcome, too. Tours cost $5. Plus, we have a wonderful gift shop with T-shirts, shot glasses, baseball caps, and the largest selection of Native American jewelry. Take I-80 East, exit 28, 15 minutes from downtown. Follow the signs to the Wild Horse Canyon from the exit, and that's where you'll find us.
I'm attorney Marilyn York, and my firm exclusively focuses on men's rights in divorce, child custody, and family law matters. 90% of homeless and runaway children are from fatherless homes. 71% of all high school dropouts come from fatherless homes. These shocking statistics do go on and on. And yet, in the context of divorce and separation, 50% of mothers see no value in the father's continued contact with their children. 40% of mothers report that they have interfered with their father's visitation solely to punish their ex. We can help you protect your children from being a part of these statistics, even when their mothers won't. Our courts do care about you and your children. At a minimum, you need legal advice when you're going through something like this, and you may need representation. If you do, call me, Marilyn York, at 324-7979. That's 324-7979. Or visit our website at marilynyork.net.
If you've never visited the Wild Horse Saloon, you need to come out and visit. It's Nevada's most unique saloon with great food, great libations, amazing entertainment 24 hours a day. What kind of entertainment, you ask? Well, the Wild Horse Saloon has brought back live burlesque shows, with new shows starting every hour, 24 hours a day, with different entertainers every hour. No show is ever the same twice. So come to the Wild Horse. Throw your legs over the saddle. We have actual Western saddle bar stools, and order a cold beer. The Wild Horse Saloon is the place to go and let your hair down. Just have fun. We have fabulous food with everything from pizzas and wings to hamburgers and steaks. We're a huge lunch spot from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., and we serve our full food menu until 10 at night, and hors d'oeuvres the rest of the night. I'm Susan Austin, and I'm personally inviting you to come out and see us at the Wild Horse Saloon. Take I-80 East to exit 28. It's just 15 minutes from downtown Reno. Follow the signs to the Wild Horse Canyon from the exit. See you soon.
Fox News Radio, 1270.
You're back on the Marilyn York Show, and we have Dr. William O'Donohue in the studio to talk about sex addiction. So now we're talking about how it's treated, Doctor. How do you treat sex addicts, the few that are actually qualifying as such?
Well, I think the first point that I would want to make is that it is not clear that we have effective treatments.
Okay.
Now, one mistake that people make is they say, well, if you have a problem, go see a psychotherapist. And that's kind of a nice general notion, but it's a little like saying if you have cancer, just go see an oncologist. Sometimes oncologists can cure you, and we can cure
sometimes
depression, and sometimes, yeah, we don't have effective therapies.
Okay.
What we look at is, do we have randomly controlled trials that show that we're effective, that we can take, put people in control group, put people in treatment group, and show that people in the treatment group are cured of this at a much higher rate than the no treatment group. We do not have any of those kind of studies.
Is this still new conceptually? Is that part of the issue?
It is a couple decades old. I think what's fairer to say is that this is a really tough problem to treat, and especially to treat successfully and have no relapse. That just like substance abuse, you know, we're also not very effective at treating substance abuse. We are fairly effective at getting people detoxed and getting people essentially not to use their substances for the first 3 months or 6 months. We're not very effective at a 1 year or 2 year long-term assessment. So the same thing we have with sex addiction, that when they're in therapy, we can see some progress, but years later, they may have relapsed back to their old level. So,
well, and I would think sex in general is less stigmatizing than, say, alcohol or drug use. I mean, assuming you're doing it in a healthy range of normal, even if it's constant, even if there's some deviance, you're going to be perhaps praised, as our prior caller indicated, in some circles rather than judged like you would be.
I think you're right. There's that dimension. But the other dimension I think is different is that we have a daily biological drive. I think one reason why there's so much obesity in the United States is because we have a daily biological drive to consume calories. And if we don't we don't do this correctly, balance it with exercise, we become obese. We also have a daily drive for sexuality. And again, some people's daily drive, as the first caller talked about, is two or three times. But we have this biological need that arises each day. And so each day for a sex addict, it's challenging to control that. Where we don't have a biological need, a drive that comes every day to drink whiskey or to take meth.
Yeah. And of course, until you're addicted.
Exactly. That's correct.
All right. Well, what about the internet? Because I've seen a lot of things that seem to, the internet's in every questionnaire, for example, internet access, Craigslist casual encounters, dating on the internet, accessibility to porn, you know, Facebook's a place where people like to cheat. Has the internet made this problem easier to, I guess, make a problem, harder to combat when it is a problem? Does it give more accessibility to those addicts that are out there?
Correct. Yeah, it does. That essentially it allows much more access to pornography. It allows much more access to deviant sorts of acts. So many of the patients that I see, there's a web component to their sexual addiction and a web component. So, for example, a wife finds a history page or finds pop-ups coming up that are deviant pornography, and this causes a problem in the relationship. Or they're at work and they get caught spending hours on porn sites.
Well, and you can get sex either on the internet using a webcam, so it's like mutual masturbation, or you can just find casual encounters Craigslist. Dell and I have a little hobby where we like to read Craigslist casual encounters when we're bored, and it's amazing. Like, I'm in traffic in Los Angeles and I just went to the dentist. I have a free hour. Want to get together at a parking lot and have sex? And we're like, holy cow. And they show you a picture of their man unit and compare it to a Butterfinger, so you know how large it is.
And there's also, you know, for a long while, there was a lot of phone sex, and there was there's a lot of encounters. Yeah. I once had a undergraduate who worked in my lab, and she worked for a credit card company, and she could approve people going over their limits a slight amount. Like if your limit was $3,000 and you're going to go and it's going to be $10 over. So she'd have to look at people's credit history. And what she was shocked about is how many men essentially use their credit cards, that the single biggest charge to their credit cards was phone sex and web sex.
Wow. I did not know. And I know that our local whorehouse, you know, they take credit cards, but it doesn't show up as the whorehouse on there. So she doesn't even know how many whores they're getting when she looks at their credit history. So is there medication, doctor, out there that assists with sexual addiction if someone actually has this, you know, diagnosis?
Well, what I would say is, three things. One, again, there's no randomly controlled trials to show that this medication works. Doctors do what is called off-label prescribing, which is essentially saying, well, this works for obsessive-compulsive disorder. This is, in some sense, a compulsion. You don't have control over it, so let's try it for this.
Okay.
But there's no clear scientific evidence that that is a good treatment. Some people report some benefits. And third, there's anti-androgens. Anti-androgens essentially stop testosterone, which is the causes the sex drive in both males and females. And it stops it from working. The trouble is it'll wipe all sex drive out, and it'll change all secondary male characteristics. Males will have higher voices. They won't have beards, So it's pretty drastic.
Is that something they use for, like, pedophiles or sex offenders?
Correct.
Is that part of a sentence sometimes, a criminal sentence, that they have to be on this sort of medication if they get released? Do you know?
I haven't seen that, no.
Seems like it'd be an effective treatment, assuming you could monitor their intake of it. What is the sex addiction workbook that you authored, doctor, and how does it help in the treatment of these addicts?
Yes, I co-authored that with one of my graduate students, and essentially we put a cognitive behavioral therapy called relapse prevention in a book form. And we did this because many people either can't afford, or there's not an expert in their local community, if they live in, for example, rural Nevada, or they're embarrassed and they don't want to go talk to a professional. So we essentially tried to put what we do have the best evidence for, this relapse prevention approach, in a book form that make it more accessible. And the relapse prevention approach essentially says, let's look at the chains of behavior that have resulted in an episode of you being out of control. So what happened? Was it in the evening? Were you feeling lonely? Did you first look at porn? Did you have a fight with your spouse? And we'll look at these chains, and then we'll try to intervene at the chains. We'll try to teach them how other ways to deal with their loneliness. We'll try to improve their relationship with the spouse so there's less fights. We also teach, as a second component, victim empathy. There's often victims in sexual addiction. That could be the wife who's, you know, hurt, like in the Tiger Woods incident. There could be prostitutes who maybe, you know, are underage and being pimped. And so we attempt to essentially educate the person in about people they're hurting to decrease the likelihood that they'll do these events. And there's about 10 other components to this, but that's an example of the kind of things we do.
I saw in one of the studies the reports on Tiger Woods' inpatient treatment that they had the wives write a victim letter, and then the husbands had to do an empathy letter, and they said that they'd read it in the group therapy setting, and typically the husbands had to be sent out to rewrite their letter because it lacked the empathy that it was supposed to include. Is that kind of the thing that you're talking about? Do you actually have some examples or letters in your workbook from victims?
Yeah, we have details, detailed descriptions. You're right. Empathy means this emotional kind of connection. Now, we all lack empathy in some sense, right? So
that's how we survive, for crying out loud.
Exactly right. So I can say your last purchase of new shoes,
like you're looking at my account right now.
you could have known that you could have taken that money and given it to African children and got them malaria shots.
Or even your own kids.
Or your own kids, exactly. So we all do things that are somewhat kind of selfish and somewhat sort of unempathic. But what we're trying to do here is hone in and really build these empathy skills so they realize that when they're doing this, yes, they may get pleasure, but at the same time, they're having a much more forceful emotional reaction that they're hurting someone.
Is there an opposite of sexual addiction, like sexual anorexia, I read somewhere?
Yeah, in the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, the one that we use to make diagnoses, it's called low sexual desire disorder. We also have trouble defining that.
Well, of course. But is it physical as well, like maybe low testosterone, or is there some component that's psychological that can be treated in that respect?
In most of the cases, the biggest component is psychological.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. So perhaps they go together. I would imagine that, you know, a woman that should, say, suffer from this might perceive her husband as an addict or vice versa, or he's supposedly an addict addicted to porn because his wife's not having sex with him. So do you treat couples that have, you know, counteracting disorders?
Yes, that we treat sexual dysfunction, individual sexual dysfunction too. One of the biggest causes of low sexual desire disorder are women who have been sexually traumatized, women that have been raped, sexually abused. Sex becomes a much more complex emotional experience for them.
It reminds me of the Billy Bob Thornton story I read, where apparently he slept with his sex therapist while he's being treated for cheating on Angelina Jolie with a string of groupies and many members of their staff. But if Angelina Jolie can't keep a man faithful, then I give up.
Well, Cindy Crawford, too, had the same problem with Richard Gere.
Thanks for listening to The Marilyn York Show with Dr. William O'Donohue.
Fox News Radio, AM 1270, KBZZ, Sparks, Reno, a service of Americom Broadcasting.